We'll hear arguments first this morning in Garcia against San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority and the related case. Mr. Solicitor General, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether Congress can constitutionally prescribe wage and hour limitations for the employees of San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority, which is a public entity under Texas law. It is undisputed that but for SAMTA's public status, Congress would clearly have this authority pursuant to its Commerce Clause powers. In setting the case for re-argument, the Court has asked that the parties address the question whether or not the principles of the Tenth Amendment, as set forth in National League of Cities versus Ussery, should be reconsidered. Our answer to that question is that those principles must be preserved. The difference between the power of the federal government to regulate private businesses and to regulate the states as states is rooted solidly not only in the Tenth Amendment, but also in the broader principle of federalism that is both historically and also structurally a mainstay of the Constitution itself. It is a principle which this Court has consistently and unequivocally reaffirmed on four separate occasions subsequent to National League, and whose doctrinal foundations and the precedents of this Court reach back more than a century prior to National League. This does not mean, however, that the appellees should win this case. The key issue is the requirement that the local government show that the federal law impairs its ability to structure integral operations in areas of traditional governmental functions. I'll discuss in just a moment our view that the supports that this test, this traditional governmental functions test, imports an historical standard. But under no conceivable meaning of that term have the appellees in this case satisfied that third of the Virginia surface mining test requirements. The district court acknowledged that the historical record is not one of predominantly public ownership and operation of transit services. And the American Public Transit Association itself is recognized in its official public literature, and I quote, "Public ownership of transit is a recent development." A House report issued in 1964 observed that as late as 1960, 95% of local transit services were privately owned and operated. And it was not until the late 1970s that the majority of this country's transit systems were publicly owned. Indeed, it is quite apparent, as explained on pages 26 through 34 of our first brief, that the change from private to public dominance in the mass transit field is directly attributable to federal funding, sought by local governments in the early 1960s on the basis of pleas by them that without massive federal aid, the change from private to public ownership would not be possible and service might cease. Typical of the representations that were made to Congress was the statement by San Antonio itself, and I'm quoting, "If we do not receive substantial help from the federal government, San Antonio may join the growing ranks of cities that have inferior transportation or may end up with no transportation at all."
General Lee, may I ask whether the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act requirements apply to all federal employees? Do you know? Do you know which ones might be exempted, if any are?
I'm just going to have to check on that. I would assume that they do, but I'm not certain. The Sixth Circuit, we submit, was quite correct when it stated in the Kramer case that tradition for these purposes must be gauged in light of what actually happened. And what happened is a federal program of local transit services in which the states participate as latecomer junior partners. There is therefore no tradition, and I'm still quoting from the Sixth Circuit, of the states qua states providing mass transportation. There is a related point. Congress did not have to accomplish its mass transit spending objectives the way the states requested. Congress could have given the subsidy direct to the private carriers instead of to state and local governments. And in this respect, the case is very much like FERC versus Mississippi. Central to the Court's holding in FERC, as I read that opinion, is the common sense proposition that by acceding to an alternative preferred by the states, Congress should not be taken to have forfeited Commerce Clause powers that it otherwise clearly has and that would be unassailable if Congress had accomplished its objective other than the way the states requested. We submit that the same principle applies here. Probably the dominant theme of the briefs filed by the appellees and their amici is that the ability of state and local governments to make certain policy choices otherwise available to them may be impaired in the event that the federal government has the authority to set wage rates for their employees. And as a starting point, that is a relevant argument, because we agree that, as this Court said in Firth versus Mississippi and has repeated several times since, the authority to make policy choices, to make policy decisions, is probably the quintessential attribute of sovereignty. But we find it ironic that the appellee's position in this respect purports to be based on federalism, because the authority to make fundamental policy decisions is no less an essential attribute of sovereignty for Congress than it is for the states. And both are affected by this case. Because while it is true that SAMHSA's ability to make some mass transit policy choices could be affected if the federal government regulates its wages and hours, it is equally true that SAMHSA's wage and hour decisions, if left to their unfettered control, can also limit Congress's ability to regulate Congress. And the reason is that wage and hour decisions by a publicly owned mass transit employer will have just as much effect on interstate commerce as the same decisions, the same wage and hour decisions, by a non-governmental mass transit employer. And if there is one thing that is clear concerning Congress's Commerce Clause prerogatives, it is that the authority to decide, the power to decide concerning the effects on interstate commerce, the comparative effects of different kinds of practices, lies solidly within Congress's stewardship. And this brings us to the crucial issue of what should be the governing constitutional standard. The reason that there is a constitutional issue in this case is that a central structural feature of our Constitution is the side-by-side existence of two sets of governments. And in any case like this one, where you have federal regulation under the Commerce Clause of the states qua states, then the complete and uninhibited exercise of sovereign power by either of these sets of governments creates a potential conflict with the sovereign powers of the other. That is the constitutional problem, and if the governing constitutional standard is to be adequate, it must take that fact into account. We accept the overruling of Maryland versus Wirtz that was accomplished in National League of Cities, and
so
we are not.
You would have been on the other side of the National League of Cities then. I mean, you wouldn't have been making the argument that the government made in National League of Cities.
Had I been the Solicitor General at the time of Maryland versus Wirtz,
National League of Cities.
Had I been the Solicitor General at the time of National League of Cities, I would have taken the same position that the Solicitor General took in that case. But in the interim since that time, National League of Cities has been decided. There is a rather comprehensive body of law that has developed, including this three-part test plus a balancing safety valve, which we think gets it just right, so long as there is an understanding as to what is meant by traditional. There has been some reliance by the states on that test, and there is a significant interest in preserving the existing precedents of this court. And
well,
for that
General
reason,
Lee, how does a focus on the historical services provided by a state serve to protect the more fundamental ability of the state to make and carry out its policy choices as a sovereign? I'm not sure that I understand how that serves us well in protecting sovereign rights of states.
It serves to protect sovereign rights of states and the sovereign rights of Congress, Justice O'Connor, and this is absolutely fundamental to our case, the answer to that question. We start from the premise, as I've just developed, that the basic constitutional problem is that ours is a federal system, And that if you concentrate only, as my opponents do, on the fact with which we have no dispute, that the unfettered exercise by Congress of its powers can erode some state prerogatives, then that leads you in one direction. Mr. Garcia, on the other hand, focuses in his brief on an equally correct proposition, which is that the unfettered exercise by the states of their prerogatives to make wage in our decisions, if there are no limitations, can also limit Congress's authority, which it otherwise clearly has, to make decisions concerning effects on Congress. Our point of view is that this Court really did get it right when, in Hodel versus Virginia Surface Mining, and three subsequent occasions, it said that it's to be that the test is to be three parts plus a balancing safety valve, which permits us to take into account the fact that there is this equipoise, the need to accommodate the competing interests of both state and federal. Now, as to the basis for the historical test, we think that the historical test is also sensitive to the competing needs of both sets of governments. Because on the one hand, once again, you can say that regardless of when the states come into the field, their problems do relate to legitimate police power objectives.
Mr. Solicitor General, are we not talking really in the broadest sense of the power of Congress to regulate compensation of state and city and county employees? In other words, we're not talking just about a transit system. We're talking about sewage and water and streetlights.
Well, all we're talking about in this case itself, of course, is the applicability of the Fair Labor Standards Act to
but
San Antonio.
But we're also talking about broad constitutional principles and the division of or allocation of power between state and federal governments.
That is correct. There are those issues in the background, but I would urge that the only issue that needs to be decided at this time is the narrow issue of wages.
Now, issue really is who pays it, which entity pays the compensation of state and city employees. And if the federal government starts down this road, where does one stop it?
Well, that is an issue, and that is the perspective from what that, yes. That is the question as placed in the perspective from the appellee's standpoint. But I can also say that there is a question concerning the prerogative of Congress to set to regulate commerce. The appellees have very properly raised the question. Probably the dominant theme in the appellee's briefs is a concern that if they lose this case, there will be an adverse impact on their, and particularly if our historical test is adopted, that this will freeze their prerogatives to enter new fields. My answer to that, and to further answer to your question, Justice Powell, is that there is nothing in this historical test which freezes in any way or adopts any kind of a static view which prevents the states from entering new fields. All it says is that when they do enter new fields, if it is a field that is already subject to regulation by Congress, then they may have to enter it subject to the same, to some reasonable Commerce Clause regulations of the same type that their private competitors are already facing. And that is a principle that has been established by this Court at least as early as 60 years ago in Helvering versus Powers, and has been reiterated numerous occasions since then in California, United States versus California, Hardin versus Terminal Railway.
The Solicitor General is the competitor of a private mass transit system in today's terms. What competitors are there?
Well, there, of course, at the present time, it is dominantly a field that is dominated. It is a field that is dominated by public transit systems, though I would add quickly and parenthetically that that came about because of this massive federal aid. But at the time, the issue really must be gauged as of the time that the states first entered the field. And you have to ask, in answering this question, has there been a law, is this a traditional governmental function?
This time point troubles me. Are you talking about a majority of the states or state by state? And before you answer that question, my next question would be, are you talking about city by city or county by county? Or what is the limit of the standard you advocate?
No, I think you have to look at it as a national problem.
A majority of the states?
I don't think that it would be profitable to look at it. I don't think it would be that helpful to look at in terms of a majority. Indeed, I would urge that that issue not be reached in this particular case, but that the only decision that be reached in this particular case is that where you have the circumstance that you had here, where prior to the massive federal aid, and indeed where you had federal regulation in the employment relations field reaching back to 1935, and at least as early as 1961, that you had federal regulation applying to transit employees, and a circumstance in which, as of 19, there simply were not well-established patterns of state ownership already in the field at the time that the federal government entered. Now, I grant,
Mr. Lee, I take it these questions, for me anyway, raise a secondary question, and that is whether the traditional governmental function test is a correct one. I take it you feel it is.
Indeed I do, Justice Blackmun. We think that the entire approach is sound, and an integral part of that approach is the third test, which is the traditional governmental function.
But this is why you're getting these questions from the bench.
That is correct. That is correct. And I wish to emphasize that we do believe that that test is a sound one, and it's sound for three reasons. One is, it has the force of precedent behind it. The second is that it is responsive to the basic underlying constitutional problem. You cannot focus simply on the problems under federalism that the states have or the problems under federalism that the Congress has. You have to accommodate in some way both of them. And we believe that this historical test accomplishes that. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Mr. Gold.
Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, it is our position that there are several different and distinct arguments, each of which leads to the conclusion that the application of the Fair Labor Standards Act to publicly owned mass transit systems is constitutional. There are certain broader arguments than those made by the Solicitor General for that proposition, which I wish to begin with. I also agree for the individual appellants here that the arguments, the basic argument that he has made concerning the situation in which the states and localities move into an area which was pioneered primarily by the private sector, and do so under conditions in which the federal government is a major cause of the states and localities' interests, entrance into that field, is not a situation in which the states thereafter can claim that the exercise of that authority, free and clear of federal authority, is essential to federalism. In this system that we have of both a federal and state government, to say that such an example of cooperative federalism, where the federal government, no less than the states and localities, is part and parcel of creating the regime in which the states and localities are providing a goods and are providing a good or service, is one which expands state authority and narrows federal authority, seems to us to be impermissible. There are at least two arguments which have broader ramifications than the argument I've just outlined and on which we agree with the Solicitor General. The first, which I think I ought to begin by saying, would require the overruling of National League and Cities, National League of Cities, is that the system of federalism, which we all agree the Constitution creates, is a system in which the national government has enumerated powers, but is supreme within those enumerated powers, and where the distinctive feature is that the national government does not have plenary powers. We believe that the argument for that proposition has three basic components. The first is the language of the Supremacy Clause and of the Tenth Amendments themselves. The Supremacy Clause says, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any states to the contrary notwithstanding." And the Tenth Amendment says simply that powers, quote, "not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." And all this against the background, as I have said, of a Constitution which does not say that the national government shall have plenary power, but rather enumerate certain powers, including the power to regulate commerce, and which includes also those powers necessary and proper to carry out that basic authority, an authority which was indeed the very foundation of the process which led to the formation of this nation and the rejection of the Articles of Confederation. We set out in our brief on re-argument at pages 5 to 12 and then in our reply brief on re-argument at pages 2 to 10 the understandings that underlie the bare words and the structure that I have just stated. We take Madison as the embodiment of the consensus on these major questions of structure and relationship, and we trace what he said in particular in the Federalist Papers and thereafter. That is not a submission that lends itself to oral presentation, but I wish to note two brief snippets. They can be judged in context by the totality of our presentation. While serving in Congress, Madison stated during the debates over the creation of the Bank of the United States, "Interference with the power of the states was no constitutional criterion of the power of Congress. If the power was not given, Congress could not exercise it. If given, they might exercise it, although it should interfere with the laws or even the constitutions of the states." And the Constitutional Convention, I would note, considered and rejected a proposal which would have precluded Congress from, and I quote, "interfering with the government of the individual states in any matter of internal policy with which respects the government of such state only and wherein the general welfare of the United States is not concerned."
Mr. Gold, do you think the framers of the Constitution would have envisioned that they were authorizing the federal government to tell the states how much they could pay their own employees to carry out their necessary sovereign functions?
I think, Justice O'Connor, that the answer to that question is the following. is what follows. The states and localities at the time of the adoption of the Constitution had very small establishments indeed. And the basic question of the extent to which the commerce power would eventually expand seems to us to be canceled out by the fact that there was also a belief at the time that the wide variety of services that the government provides today would not be provided by the states and localities at all. I am quick to add that the essential animating concern in the two National League of Cities argument and this argument is the one that you have stated. I can only say two things about that argument that concern insofar as it applies to those activities that are truly and uniquely governmental. One, as Justice Harlan said in Maryland versus Wirtz, any activity of the federal government under the commerce power has to be shown to be an activity which an action based on an effect on commerce. I am not clear that an attempt to regulate the governor or the legislatures or their staffs could pass that test. I don't want to argue the point one way or the other, because the interesting fact of 200 years of history is that it has never occurred. The founding fathers, insofar as they were concerned about the states and state sovereignties, put their faith in a political system rather than in a system which would provide that the federal government has enumerated powers with an exception that the court shall judge whether those enumerated powers unduly interfere with state sovereignty, and the trust has not yet been abused. What was said in the tax immunity cases by Justice Frankfurter with regard to creating doctrine on worst-case fears ought to be remembered in this context as well. The beginning of my answer to your question also gets me to the second distinct argument we would make, and that is that the production of goods and services is not an essential of state sovereignty. In preparing for this argument, I was reading through a book called American Public Works Association, History of Public Works in the United States, 1776-1976, cited in the Solicitor General's opening brief. There was little or nothing in the way of the production of goods and services.
Forgive me for interrupting you,
yes.
But when you use the term services, the state does very little beyond providing services for the public. So is there any limitation to your use of the word services?
Yes, Justice Powell. It is our view that there are certain activities of the states which we just do not regard as a good and service that is rendered in common with the private sector that has historically been rendered in common. And that is making an enforcement of public law. And
but the typical category of services that the public is interested in primarily and that have thought to have been subject to local democratic control, basically you start with police and fire and streets and light. All of those, I take it from your brief, you would say are subject to the Commerce Clause.
No, the police seems to... I apologize, Your Honor.
Well, you said they are not subject to the Commerce Clause. Are all of those services subject or not subject to the Commerce Clause regulation?
I started answering. I apologize for breaking in. It is our view that the police function is properly seen as part and parcel of the lawmaking and law enforcement function, and that that and we are now talking about how to delimit a National League of Cities test rather than a test rather than whether the test should be overruled entirely. It is our sense that that's part of the law enforcement function. On the other items which we have grown used to seeing as part of a widely expanded state, locality, and federal role, we say this. In almost every instance in the 18th century, the activity was performed either in whole or in part in the private sector, and that was true well into the 19th century as well. What has been the determinant factors, so far as we can tell, in looking at this history is the availability of capital in the state and locality, the capital needs, the interest of individual entrepreneurs in entering.
Powell, and your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. On re-argument, this case involves two basic questions. First, whether constitutional federalism provides any limitation on Congress's exercise of its commerce powers directly against the state to supplant core state functions such as the establishment of wages, hours, and overtime policies for state and local governments. The second question is whether local public mass transit, constituting 94% of all transit services today, is a traditional governmental function. I think since the Solicitor General agrees with so much of our position, we ought to get to the one thing on which we have the disagreement. Today, 100 out of 106 major urban communities have publicly owned local mass transit, as do all communities with transit in Texas. 94% of all transit riders nationwide ride on public mass transit. San Antonio started to supply public mass transit services in 1959, which is well before there was any attempt of federal regulation of transit or wages and hours. Now, General Lee explains his modified historical test for traditional functions as follows. The state activity must be well established prior to the development of the federal regulatory presence in the field. Public transit, we submit, clearly meets this test and is not distinguishable from the traditional activities the Solicitor General concedes were correctly protected at National League of City. I'd ask you to turn to page 2 of SAMHSA's original brief to show you the legislative history. Enacted in 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act expressly exempted all states and their political subdivisions and all transit systems, public or private, from the minimum wage and overtime provisions. Furthermore, the National Labor Relations Act, enacted in 1935, exempts all public agencies, including transit systems, an exemption that continues until today. The first attempt to extend any Fair Labor Standard provisions to any private transit system was in 1961, when minimum wage coverage only was extended only to a few private systems, those which had revenues in excess of $1 million. Now, that doesn't sound like much today, but project yourself back to 1961, and you will realize that that meant that very few private systems were covered. Then all public systems remained completely exempt according to the express language of the statute. The city of Philadelphia, the city of San Antonio, as I said, began to furnish the service in 1959. Thus, we have a picture where Congress expressly exempted public transit service from FLSA and NLRA requirements during the period in which such transit became well established as a common local governmental service. By 1965, before there was any attempt by Congress to cover any public transit system, the majority of transit employees worked for public transit companies, some 56%. In 1966, Congress extended the minimum wage requirements to public hospitals, schools, and only those public systems whose rates and services were regulated by a state or local public utility commission. Transit operators, private and public, continued to be exempt from all overtime provision. And you recall it was in 1965 when the UMPTA statute was passed, and there's not a word in that statute, as you recognize, Mr. Justice Blackmun, in Jackson Transit Company, which said that if the cities took the money, that there would be any condition of federal regulation with respect to wages and hours. In fact, you said, Your Honor, in that case, that that statute specifically says that wages and hours and other labor conditions were to be left to local law.
Mr. Coleman, could I just ask this question? In your historical development, I suppose it would be perfectly clear under your argument that Congress would not have the power to apply Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to your client either.
Oh, no, sir. Look, the one thing is clear. The 14th Amendment was a dramatic passage of saying that that was one thing in which the federal government had the power to interfere with respect to states.
But if they had just relied on the commerce power, they could not have done
it. They could not have done it, and that's what they clearly relied upon here.
But you say that this limit applies to exercise the commerce power but does not apply to exercises of power under the 14th Amendment.
Well, I would say that I have to look at the members on the court. Some of you have indicated, as you did, Mr. Justice Brennan, the EOC versus Wyoming, that when you get around to exercise power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, that the 10th Amendment or federalism has no restriction whatsoever. The Chief Justice, and there were three that joined you, said that even there was a restriction, although the restriction obviously was of different nature. But I would say that there ought to be some restriction even when you're proceeding under Section 5, because I believe that one thing in this country which is very important, that we do preserve the independent and separate existence of the state. And I don't think that under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment that Congress can do something which destroys that independent existence and separate existence of the state. As I was saying, we have a picture here that, one, you have no regulation of public transit specifically, no regulation of private transit, and it was only in 1974 that Congress attempted to extend minimum wage and hour and overtime provision to all public transit systems. Prior to the time that Congress attempted to do that, the state practice had become entrenched because prior to the time that Congress enacted, 90% of all transit services were provided by public transit agencies. Thus, publicly owned local mass transit meets even the Solicitor General's own ill-founded and unprecedented historic test for traditional governmental activity. For 30 years, as the states assumed this vital service, Congress told the states that they would be exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act. Even when Congress provided an UMPTA for assistance to local transit, it did not intend to disrupt the settled practices of labor relations governed solely by state law, and that's what was held in Jackson Transit. In fact, the government's unsupported historical test bears no relations to the purpose for federalism, restraints on commerce clause regulation of the states as states. Federalism ensures that state and local governments can fulfill their role in the union by providing those governmental services which their citizens require. Whether an activity has been historically public has nothing to do with the present-day realities of state involvement in providing the modern requirement of a state citizenry. Clearly, the word traditional doesn't necessarily mean historical. For example, for decades, the tradition in this court, when I stood before this court, was to address the justices as Mr. Justice. In the last 3 or 4 years, the tradition has become instructed to address them as Justice. In any event, this court decision rejects the equation of traditional with the passage of many decades. The decisions do not support the suggestion that even if the service is now supplied by most state and local governments, it is not traditional merely because the current public sector pervasiveness does not have ancient historic roots. That, in fact, in National League of Cities, the services protected were defined sometimes as integral, other times as important, and also at other times as traditional. Long Island Railroad clearly states that traditional does not give rise to a historic test. The court held the same in New York versus the United States. I think in this case, Your Honors, these systems had become public and were traditional even before Congress gave any money to the systems. In addition, when Congress gave the money to the systems, it did not say that the systems had to abide by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And your cases make it clear, Jackson Transit and the Pennhurst, that unless Congress says that if you want the money, you have to abide by this condition, that you do not read conditions and impose them on the local government. The other argument the Solicitor General makes is that somehow you will have unfair competition between the private and the public systems if you don't apply the Fair Labor Standards Act. The language that he quotes in his brief was describing the situation which led to the passage of the 1966 Act, which covered hospitals, schools, and some transit companies. And this court rejected that argument in National League of Cities. In addition, I would just ask you to see whether when, for example, in San Antonio, it costs you 60 cents per passenger to give the service, and the passenger pays only 18 cents or 10 cents if a school child or the elderly or the handicapped, or if they ride downtown in order to eliminate traffic congestion, to promote unemployment, to promote employment, and to serve the people, it's for free. I would just ask you how one can come in and compete with that type of system. So it is clear that the competition argument certainly has no relevancy here. Now, the next argument that the Solicitor General makes, but he hasn't made it at the bar of this court today, but when you read his brief, you're not quite sure what he's talking about when he says it's the state core function which is to be to protect it. We think it is clear that the cases say that the state core function is the ability to fix wages and hours and overtime policies. That's what was said in the National League of Cities. That's what was said in EOC. That's what was said in the FERC case. It is not that we also have to show, as the government at certain places suggests, that the functioning or providing of transit service, if you end the existence of the city. And in Long Island Railroad, the Chief Justice made it quite clear that when he held that the railroads were subject to federal regulation, he said that we're dealing with the third prong of the test, which is solely whether the railroads is a traditional governmental function. In fact, there were only two of them. The fact that there had been a long history of government regulation made the difference. I'd now like for a moment to turn to the question of the federal constitutionalism, which really answers the argument made by the union. It is clear that when the Constitution was set up, that states were to remain and they would have separate and independent existence. If that's so, then if you don't have a constitutional federal limitation, Congress could presumably even tax a percentage of all revenues collected by state taxes. I think Justice Blackmun in dissent in Nevada versus Hall made it clear, however, that there is an implicit federalism restriction on Congress and the states. He says, "I would find that source for Nevada's sovereign immunity not an expression of the Constitution, but in a guarantee that is implied as an essential component of federalism. The Court has had no difficulty in implying the guarantee of freedom of association or implying a right of interstate travel. I have no difficulty in accepting the same argument for the existence of a constitutional doctrine of interstate sovereign immunity. The only reason why this immunity did not receive specific mention in the Constitution that it was too obvious to deserve mention. It is for me significantly fundamental to our federal structure to have implicit constitutional dimension." Now, we have collected on page 17, footnote 15 of APTA's supplemental brief, other cases where constitutional limitations are found implicit from the structure and language of the Constitution. In fact, I stand before you and say that few such principles are more often reiterated than this, that the framers' notion of the continued separate and independent existence of the states places a limitation on Congress's exercise of its plenary powers against state and local government.
If you were arguing this for the first time, or if the issue had just come up for the first time, would you be more likely to have made that kind of a federalism argument than to try to pose it under the 10th Amendment?
Well, it's also the 10th Amendment, but and you get to the 10th Amendment in one of two ways. One,
well,
and
you
I
can
think,
get to it the other way. There's no
well,
need to.
No, I'll tell you. I'd like to give you the problem, Your Honor. One, if you follow
you have it, all right.
The approach of Justice Brennan, he would say that within the Commerce Clause, if what you're trying to do is to destroy the separate and independent existence of the state, that he would read the Commerce Clause as not going that far. And so, therefore, he would say the power wasn't delegated. Within the other approach, and I think the cases tend to support this, is that, one, you assume that under the Commerce Clause that the federal government has plenary powers. And if it's Commerce and any person today after Wickett and Filburn and the Katzenbach case can spell out how anything affects interstate commerce. But there are other provisions of the Constitution also. And it's clear, for example, that even though you exercise the plenary power under the Commerce Clause, you could not say, and on the trains, people can't speak or read the newspaper. Why? Not because that's not a regulation of commerce, but because of the First Amendment. By the same token, you say that as you look at the Constitution, and if you say that there should be separate and independent existence of the state, there's certain things that the state that the federal government can't do because that would seriously affect and destroy the existence of the state.
Even though the power was otherwise there.
The power was there, but the same way the power's there, then you go to the First Amendment or you go to the Fifth Amendment to limit it. Here you go to the structure of the Constitution and to say that...
That was the basis of the tax immunity cases, wasn't it?
Well, that's the basis of the tax immunity cases. It's the basis of the Ashton case dealing with the bankruptcy case as to whether you can force a city to go into reorganization. Now, with respect to the Commerce Clause, for example, Mr. Justice Marshall for the Court in Frye, footnote 7, says it. In Hodel versus Virginia Surface Mining, again for the Court, he says it, as well as he says it in concurring opinion in Employees versus Missouri Department of Public Health and Welfare. Mr. Justice Brennan for the Court in EOC versus Wyoming at footnote 18 says it. The dissenting opinion of the Chief Justice in EOC and his opinion for the Court in Long Island Railroad says it, in which, incidentally, it was a unanimous opinion. The dissenting opinion of Justice Powell in EOC says it. The principle has also been asserted by Justice Blackmun in his concurring opinion in National League and his opinion for the court in FERC versus Mississippi.
Mr. Coleman, I have to confess, what do they all say?
They all say that when you exercise plenary power under the Commerce Clause, that there's a limitation which is based in constitutional federalism, that you have to recognize that the convention intended to keep the states separate and distinct, and therefore there is this limitation.
But do they all say that the organ of the government that was going to keep them from going too far was necessarily the judiciary rather than the Congress? Because after all, the states are rather well represented in Congress.
Well, they say that's on that point. I first like to say, to answer twofold. One, there's no presumption of constitutionality here, because the one thing that's clear, that Congress enacted the 1974 amendment only because this court in Maryland versus Wirtz said that there was no such principle of constitutional federalism and the federal government had absolute power. And so now, since when in National League you reverse that, it's hard to say that there's still a presumption, a normal presumption. Secondly, the one thing's clear, that when there was a dispute between the various organs of government,
Mr. Coleman, my question is directed at what the framers probably thought would be the correct protection against having the federal government devour the states. Would it be the judiciary or the Congress itself in which the states are represented?
Ultimately, it would be the judiciary. Mr. Ellsworth, who I think was the second Chief Justice of the United States, he says it, and we quote where he says it. It's also said by the other people that where there is a dispute between the federal government and the state as to whether this type of action was appropriate within the Constitution, that the federal judiciary was to make the determination. I'd also suggest in the Charter case, where there the dispute is between the Congress and the President of the United States, and each one felt that what they were doing was right correctly, and each one was equally familiar with federalism and everything else and separation of powers, but there this court made the determination. Also, in the Nixon tape case, you had the same problem where you had...
Yes, but in this case, you have a peculiar situation because the issue is one that vitally affects the states, and they are the ones who, in turn, have the primary control over Congress through their own representatives,
which is not true
in the Chadha situation.
I would suggest that you pull up any governor, any one of the 50 states, and ask him whether he thinks that his state is protected in everything that the state wants to do, because there's two senators down here from that particular state or they're members of the House down here. I just don't think that you can say that the states, because they have members in the Congress, are nevertheless don't have a separate independent interest, which sometimes is not reflected. And once again, I say that even though in other cases you can say this, here you have to recognize that the reason why Congress did what he did was because you decided Maryland versus Wirtz, and now you've overruled Maryland versus Wirtz. So at least you ought to uphold the court below and say that the statute is unconstitutional. And then if Congress wants to take another look at it in light of the fact that they don't have all the power that they thought they had, then at that point the presumption argument might make some sense. But even though there's a presumption, I still think ultimately this court is the one that has to make the decision whenever there's a conflict between the federal government and the state.
Mr. Coleman. After all, regardless of how members of Congress are elected, the Congress of the United States is a part of the federal government, isn't it?
Yes, sir. That's true. Now, the other point I'd like to turn to is what impact does the Fair Labor Standards Act have on public transit service? First, we all know that both National League of Cities and EOC says that an assessment of actual impact is not necessary to resolution of the state's immunity. The federal government concurs in its brief in the lower court on this point. It is not the millions of dollars of extra compensation that is at issue here. It is the displacement of state policy choices that creates the impermissible intrusion. that interferes with an attribute of sovereignty and therefore threatens a separate and independent existence of the state. The state here, unlike in FERC, have no choice between providing the service consistent with federal law or opting not to provide it. State and local governments do not have the budgetary resources to adopt costly federal requirements whenever imposed. Most state constitutions require a balanced budget or set a limit on debt. Since labor costs are about 65% to 73% of the operating costs of transit, the Fair Labor Standards Act cost may be tremendous. State and local governments with public transit services will be forced by the FLSA to choose between raising fares or curtailing services. The person most hurt by this will be the poor, the elderly, and the disadvantaged who depend on public transit to get to school or work or to their other basic or for their other basic needs. SAMHSA, for example, at rush hour. 66% of all riders are Hispanic, 14% are black, 84% have incomes of under $15,000. Bus drivers, like policemen and firemen, must meet the public need for essential services. Schedules and working conditions are designed to respond to these needs. They cannot be tailored to 8-hour days. Furthermore, compensation is geared to the unique conditions in the transit sector and do not mesh with the requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Through the years, special premiums have evolved to compensate transit operators for split shifts, early sign-in, and travel time to locations other than the principal bus depot and other unique scheduling requirements. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, these special premiums may be included in the regular rate and therefore would greatly increase the amount of overtime costs for transit. The Solicitor General's only answer is that cities and states should renegotiate their labor contract. And I just ask you to look at all the problems when you ask any union for give-ups. And it seems to me that the one thing that National League of Cities made clear, that you ought not to impose that type of disruption on the state. And it does not lessen the undeniable fact that the state's ability to make policy choices now and in the future would be displaced by federal regulations. Also, in certain of these cities, when the transit system is acquired, the people get slotted into the general civil service ledger for other city employees. Now, can you imagine a mayor faced with the problem where he's negotiating with policemen and firemen, and you say the Fair Labor Standards Act doesn't apply, but the people performing the same type of work on a transit company, you say, oh, gee, the Fair Labor Standards Act does apply here. To be accountable and responsive to all the citizens of the local community in the provisions of important public service, and to be able to experiment, as Justice Brandeis thought so important, state and local governments must have the capacity to make the political judgments about fares, general and special tax increases, services, and the cost of providing local public transit. So subject one essential element of this local political equation to remote bureaucracy control in Washington undermines the state's political capacity to be responsive to the community it serves in providing these governmental functions that uniquely must be provided at the local level. We urge you, Your Honor, to affirm the decision of the court below.
Do you have anything you can cover in 30 seconds, Mr. Solicitor General?
Just this point, Mr. Chief Justice. Unless tradition does refer to what's happened in the past, then some opinions of this court are going to have to be rewritten, as well as some dictionaries. Unless it is an historical test, then there is to be no effective vouchsafer for the principle unanimously announced by this court in Long Island that states are not to have the power to erode federal authority. My time is up.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...